running this class through the summer? When are we stopping this class?
Let's start Perek Yud, who we are up to. Finished last week, we finished our discussion of the story of the Givonim and the breach that Yehoshua ends up making with the Givonim. Yehoshua, the Zkenim, the Nesiim, we had all kinds of different groups there, but essentially the pact that we made with the Givonim, which is situated right smack in the middle of the country. And so even though, and just as an aside, does everybody have a source? Even though Yehoshua would never have intentionally made this brit with the Givonim, does serve a certain strategical advantage to have an ally and a Baal Brit smack right in the middle of the country. There is a certain advantage to having friends in that part of the country, especially as they are continuing their military conquest. Either as it may, we start Perek Yud. Vayihi. Chishmoa Adoni Tzedek Melech Yerushalayim Ki lachad Yehoshua et ha'ay v'yachadima. When Adoni Tzedek, King of Yerushalayim, heard that Yeshua had conquered Ai and destroyed it, Kesher asal Yericho ulumalka, Ken asal Ai ulumalka, as he had done to Yericho, so he had done to Ai. Vechi shlimu yoshvei givonet Yisrael v'yu b'kirbam. And furthermore, he heard that the Givonim made peace, a pact with Israel, and now the Givonim are sitting in their kishkas, b'kirbam, in the middle of the country. Everybody with me? In the middle of the country, and they are allied with Israel. Vayir umaod. They became very fearful. Ki ir gdola Givon, ki achat arei hamavlacha. Givon was not a small little village. Givon was a major city. It was a major metropolis. It was one of the city-states. Vechi gdola min ha'ai v'chol anasheh ha'giborim. It was larger than Ai, had greater warriors. So now Adoni Tzedek, Melech Yerushalayim, is afraid. Why is Adoni Tzedek, Melech Yerushalayim, particularly engaged in this discussion? Because if you look on the map, Yerushalayim, and you have two maps. You have this one here, and you happen to have a small map on the other side of this, of the source page. It's hard really to see there. There's too much information. We'll come back to that map. But if you look at this one, you can see where Gilgal is, where the camp of Israel is, sitting in Gilgal. This is where I was, because it is no longer for all intents and purposes. And south of southwest of Ai is Givon, and southeast of Givon is Yerushalayim. Remember I told you that Givon and Kiryat Yearim, Telstone, that whole area today, Abu Ghosh, that's where the area of the Givonim are. And Yerushalayim, of course, is southeast of that. So Yerushalayim is the first major city threatened by the pact between Israel and Gilgal and the Givonim.
You said it was a major metropolis.
A major city in relative terms to the ancient world. It's a major city.
And what is that? How?
I have no idea. But if it was compared to Ai, right. We talked about Ai, it was tens of thousands of people.
So this is...
It's not a village. And therefore, it has a military strength to it. That's really the issue, that it has military strength, and if Israel makes an alliance with them, they threaten the southern region. If you remember our discussion, what were the two major strategical challenges to Yehoshua as he's embarking on this conquest of Israel? Strategically, he's challenged by two issues. One, the walled cities, and the second,
the cities wouldn't unite
that the cities shouldn't unite together and create an army of a formidable force. Each city, as a city-state by itself, is a force, but Israel is hundreds of thousands of soldiers, and the cities are tens of thousands of soldiers. So soldier to soldier, Israel has a dramatic advantage. But if you combine all the cities and all the Canaanites into one fighting army, then Israel is in serious, has a serious threat. So his fear is the unification of the cities. So he's constantly trying to divide. Here, we see the first story of an effort to unite the kings of Canaan. Interesting observation. Name of the king of Yerushalayim. Name of the king of Yerushalayim.
Adoni Tzedek.
This is the second time in Tanakh where Yerushalayim appears or is referred to by name. First, verse is close. It's not exact, but it's close. The biblical name for Yerushalayim, Tanakh, in Chumash. It's only one place in Chumash where Yerushalayim is referred to, and it is called Shalem in the story of Abraham and the four kings against the five kings. And the name of the king of Shalem, who comes out to greet Abraham at the end of the story of the battle of the four kings and the five kings,
Malkitzedek.
Now, that could be coincidental. What's more likely, when you think about it, Malkitzedek and Adoni Tzedek are exactly the same name, because Adoni means
master.
Melech. Malki, my
king.
My Adon, my Melech means the same thing. Tzedek.
Justice.
Seven. So Malki Tzedek, Adoni Tzedek, my just king, my just master. The irony of having two names of the of kings at the same city, 500 years apart, is too ironic to be an accident. And what most theories are, that in fact, Malki Tzedek, Adoni Tzedek is the same name of the king, much like Paro of Egypt is always called Paro.
Like,
in other words, like a title of the throne. The throne of Yerushalayim is called Tzedek. Malki Tzedek, Adoni Tzedek. It reflects a little bit of the nature of the city, although that's a separate issue, but certainly the notion that Melech Yerushalayim here is the same as Melech Shalem in Chumash. It's one of the sources, or one of the proofs, or supports to the theory that in fact Shalem in the story in Bereishit is Yerushalayim. Because otherwise you could argue that it's not the same city. Shalem doesn't necessarily have to mean Yerushalayim. But one of the supports to the notion that this Melech Shalem in the story of Abraham is in fact Yerushalayim is the connection between the name Malki Tzedek and Adoni Tzedek in Yehoshua. It works both ways. We can extrapolate one to the other, and assume that Shalem, Yerushalayim, Malki Tzedek, Adoni Tzedek is essentially the same area, same region, same type of king with the same title connotation.
Is this title used a lot besides
Yerushalayim? We don't have it often in outside of Yerushalayim or here. Adoni Tzedek, Malki Tzedek, I don't think there are any other names of similar style. And it's obviously a Hebraicized name. We don't know what the original Canaanite version of it was, but it's obviously the Hebrew equivalent.
Why?
Why what?
Why it's obvious that they, like, you have other places that you have a translation of the name, and not, why it will call, like, usually if you have somebody name, you call it the name it is, or you don't.
Unless it has like a, unless it was a very easy translation, like if it was a, if it was a natural translation that you from a language, remember the ancient languages are very similar to each other. So if it had a natural translation, they would have just transferred it over. That in and of itself doesn't surprise me, but the connection between Yerushalayim and Shalem is significant, and we'll see as the perek unfolds the significance, this parallel grows. So I mention it now, but we will actually see that it expands from here. Number one, another observation. We'll come back. I'm going to read through the whole parak and get a whole picture of the whole story in a moment. But another observation, just in terms of pasuk aleph, you Adoni Tzedek Melech Yerushalayim is frightened. He's going to go and gather all of his forces together. He's frightened by two things. What are the two things he hears? He hears two things. Vehi chishmo Adoni Tzedek Melech Yerushalayim ki lechad Yeshua et ha'ay ve'achrima v'chi hishlimu yoshvei givonet Yisrael v'yu b'kirba. What are the two things that he hears?
There was peace with the Givonim and
he hears about the breed with the Givonim. And what's the second thing he hears?
The Givon was greater than I.
Right, but that's actually the second thing that he hears. What's the first thing that he hears? There are two pieces of information in that first pasuk. He hears two things. What are they?
Oh,
and what do you done
you
to
recall
I?
The conquest of? In a certain sense, these two pieces of information are contradictory. Why?
One is battling and conquest, and the other one is a peace treaty, you're saying, in that sense? Or?
Well, the conquest of Ai, what's the impact of the conquest of Ai if he hears that Israel conquered Ai? What is the message there?
Ai was destroyed.
Or they're strong.
They united to attack.
Everything. Remember what we discussed about Ai. What was the story with Ai? What happened at Ai?
They underestimated.
They first sent only a few people.
Yeah. Right.
And then they sent back more, right? Isn't that
right? So, if you're a Canaanite, what was essentially the impact that you? What was the message you read in the story of Ai?
They don't have good strategic planning, or they're not.
You're doomed.
No,
sure.
Other way. It was other way.
I would say the
other
way.
That
it wasn't easy.
Right.
They came in and they weren't successful at first, and then they
I was the Amalek of the conquest of Canaan. I, in terms of the impact that it had on the Canaanites, the story of Ai served the same purpose as the story of the Battle of Amalek. Jericho was a one-way street. They walked in there and they marched over Jericho like a bunch of ants. Then they got to Ai and they got squelched. The impact for them at Canaan is a double one. Number one, yes, Israel is a force to contend with, but number two, they are not invincible. So the conquest of Ai is actually a message of hope, of motivation for the Canaanites to counter the offensive of Israel, because we failed at Ai.
Right, but in the end you said
fine. So that's exactly what happened at Amalek. Amalek lost the battle, but they won the war,
right.
Because the weakness, they proved that Israel's not invincible, that they're vulnerable.
It's different because in the end you. Destroyed Ai to Amalek. They didn't destroy Amalek in the end. It's like Mechamet Yom Kippur.
Exactly like Mechamet Yom Kippur.
But the
analogy, and we use that analogy exactly, because Mechamet Yom Kippur, we won the war. But the impact was to undo everything we had accomplished in 1967.
But this is Amalek.
Same thing with Ai.
No, because if you, in the end, at least the way I see, if they succeeded first battle, the Ai, and even so, Israel has the power to come and undo everything and destroy the town.
Exactly what happened in the Yom Kippur War. We lost the first 3 months of the war, and then we turned around and we won. And we won Begadol. We marched the Syrian army all the way back to Damascus. But the fact remains that they demonstrated that we were vulnerable. And the impact that it had was to destroy the image of the invulnerability that had been created in 1967. Nobody remembers that we won the war. All they remember is that we took enormous losses and we were on the retreat for the first 3 months of the war. It's exactly the same analogy.
But
you can win the war But that's not what people, but the impact that it has. The impact that it has was to undo the impenetrable fortress that was created by the conquest of Jericho and the split of the sea. Suddenly, these people are vulnerable.
So then why was he... that doesn't make sense to me, because it says that they had destroyed it.
They
knew that it was destroyed. So why... I'm not quite understanding why they would be less fearful, knowing that even though they were vulnerable, they would win in the end.
Because... The message that I sent was they are a force to contend with, but they're not impenetrable. And the allegiance and the alliance with Givonim, therefore, created a threat for them.
Okay.
So these are two. These the message created by the story of Ai and the message of the breach with the Givonim actually point in different directions. The message of the story of Ai was that a message of hope. With the Canaanites can beat them. They if they get it, if they're strong enough, they can actually deal with them. Look, we started at Ai. But the Brit with the Givonim challenges that message because it strengthens Israel. So you're dealing with two different stories that are not disconnected. The Brit with the Givonim and the conquest of Ai are interconnected in terms of the message they convey to the Canaanites. It's a complex message. It's not Israel is strong, look what they've done to Ai, and look what they did to Jericho, and look what they did to Givonim. It's a complex message. It's, yes, they conquered Jericho. Ai wasn't as simple as a simple walkover. They started to make britot with local people. Right? There's a complexity to that message. And therefore, from the perspective of Melech Yerushalayim, the agenda now is time. They are racing the clock. And that's why suddenly you see an effort to bring the people together that is a speedy one, because they are racing the clock. All right, let's go through the rest of the parak and see where it goes. Pasuk Gimel. Vayishlach Adoni Tzedek Melech Yerushalayim El Hoham Melech Chevron Ve'el Piram Melech Yarmut ואל יפיע מלך לחיש ואל דביר מלך אגלון לאמור. He sends a message to four major cities in the area of the south, Yerushalayim, Yarmut, from Yerushalayim he sends the message to Chevron, Yarmut, Lachish, and Dvir. Chevron, Yarmut, Lachish, and Dvir. Here are the four cities. You see them on the map? Four cities southwest of Yerushalayim. So if you look at this whole region, this is essentially what is today called Are Yehuda. This is essentially the entire region of Are Yehuda from Yerushalayim southward. Chevron, Yarmut, Lachish, and Dvir. And to those four cities, together with Yerushalayim, five cities, he sends the following message. Pasuk Dalet. Alu Elai v'izuni ונקה את גבעון כי השלימה את יהושע ואת בני ישראל. Come with me, align with me, and together we will smite whom? Givon. The tactic here, which is very smart, the tactic is to attack Givon. They're not going to start up with Israel. They don't need to. The tactic is to take out Givon. In so doing, I think they do two things. Number one, it was Givon that made the Brit with Israel. Number two, they do three things. Number one, Givon made the Brit with Israel. Number two, strategically?
Well, Israel would have to come to their aid.
Israel would have to come to their aid. Okay, Israel would have to come to their aid. That's the political side of it. And the question of whether or not Israel would is the open question. Do they know? Are they confident that Israel will assist them? Or do they think that Israel will sit this one out? And number three, Givon looked from a geographic, strategic point of view, Givon is the dead center of the country, in terms of the area here, the mountain. So if Israel is sliding across the center by conquering Ai, by taking Jericho, taking Ai and making a breach with Givon, where is Israel going? Strategically, where is Israel going? They're moving straight across the center of the country. That is a strategic threat to them, because they're going to cut the north and south off from each other. So by taking the four armies and bringing them straight north into Givon, they're hoping to create a wall of defense against the onslaught of the Israeli army. So their goal to go is to conquer Givon. Pasuk Hey. Vayesru Vayalu Chameshet Malchei HaEmori. They gathered together and came up to him, the five kings of Emori. They are Melech Yerushalayim, Melech Chevron, Melech Yarmut, Melech Lachish, Melech Eglon, Heim B'chol Machanehem. These five kings, Yerushalayim, Chevron, Yarmut, Lachish, Eglon, Vayachanu al Giv'on, Vayelachamu alah. And they encamp against Giv'on and start the campaign. Vayishlechu anshei Giv'on el Yehoshua al Hamachaneh Gilgala. Lemot. So, and Givon sent a message to Yehoshua in Gilgal and said, Al teref yadecha mi'avadecha. Don't withdraw your hands. Don't sit back. Don't play neutral. Ale eleinu mehera, come up to us quickly. V'hoshia lanu ve'azreinu, ki nikbitzu eleinu kol malchei ha'emori yoshvei ha'har. We have been attacked by all the Amorite kings in the mountain. Again, not necessarily all, but certainly all the major ones. These are the five largest powers in the south. Together, they are a formidable force. Vayal Yehoshua min ha-Gilgal, hu v'chol am ha-melchama imo v'chol gibonei ha-chayil. Yehoshua gathers together all of his forces, and he goes to war to protect Giv'on. And this is the beginning of the battle. It is called Mechamet Hadarom, the Battle of the South. Battle of Yehoshua, in defense of Givon against the conquering armies of Yerushalayim, Devir, Hebron, Lachish, and Yarmut.
Rabbi, can I ask a question?
Sure can.
I know you explained this before, and I don't remember the significance of Vayehi. Because I know you said that that's significant.
There's a midrashic source that says that anytime it says Vayihi Bimei, it's or Vayihi, that it connotes danger or calamity or potential danger. Vayihi Lashon Tzar, V'Haya Lashon Simcha. Vayihi denotes something sad, V'Haya denotes something joyful. This isn't exactly a fair comparison, because Vayihi means it was and Vayah means it will be. So our past is full of trouble, our future is full of potential. But in the Pshat, I don't think it...
Because I remember you connected it with like the Megillah Vayihi.
Right, so that's the Gemara that says that the word Vayihi, or Vayihi Bimei, always has Vayihi Bimei Shvot HaShoftim, Vayihi Bimei Achashverosh. There's always an ensuing danger. But I'm not sure in the Pshat it fits consistently, but that's the Midrashic interpretation. The significance in this story, I think, is the first time that you see the Canaanite kings uniting together. That's really the piece here that is unique. It's the first moment in response to the conquest of Canaan where you see the kings of Canaan attempting to combine together to unite in a united front against Israel. And that's one of Yehoshua's biggest challenges. In fact, the Medrash itself reflects on this. If you take a look at the Medrash Tanchuma that you have as source number one, the Medrash describes this unity in almost messianic parameters. Medrash says, Rabbi Aibo b'shem Rabbi Yossi Aglili Omer b'shlosham komot chalku ba'ei olam al kodesh baruch hu. There are three places in history where the nations of the world united to fight God. Achat Kan, this is a medrash on the story of Migdal Bavel in Parshat Noach. Vehi kol aretz safa achat udvarim achadim, the entire land was of one idea and one speech. Vehachat bimei Yehoshua, the second in the days of Yehoshua, where it says vayikbitzu yachdav lilachem im Yehoshua v'im Yisrael pe'achad. At the end of Perek Tet, or the beginning of Perek Tet, when all the nations gathered together to unite in their fight against Israel. The nations gather together against God and against His Anointed One. The notion that the nations of the world will unite together against Israel or against God, they're actually considered synonymous in the Medrash, is again the fear that it's easier to work with the nations of the world when they're in fact divided militarily and divided theologically. When they unite in a force against us, it becomes a danger. So what happens? Five kings against Gibeon. Unfair advantage. Five kings against Gibeon. Pasuk Chet. Yomer Hashem al Yehoshua, al tira mehem. God comes to Yeshua and he says, don't be afraid. The campaign hasn't started yet. They're just marching on their way up. And he says, don't be afraid of them. Ki biyatcha netatim. I will give them over into your hands. Lo yamod ish mehem bifanecha. Not one of them will stand against you. Ve'yavo alehem Yehoshua pit'om kol halayla. Yehoshua attacked them pit'om. Pit'om means?
Suddenly,
by surprise. Kol halayla ala min haGilgal. It took all night to get from Gilgal. Yehoshua moves his army under the secrecy of nightfall, of darkness, from Gilgal to Gibeon. It takes him all night long. By the time the morning comes, and instead of the five kings standing against the army of Gibeon, the five kings are looking at the army of Gibeon and all of Israel. Vayehumem Hashem lifnei Yisrael, God confounded them, confused them. Vayakem makah gdola b'Gibeon, and they smote them a great makah in Gibeon. Vayirdefem delach ma'ale bet choron, they start to retreat westward towards ma'ale bet choron. Vayakem ad azeka ve'ad makeda. They smote them all the way down to Makeda and Azeka. If you look at the map here, you can see the direction from Gibeon. Azeka is over here, west. So they're chasing them from Gibeon westward, southwest. There's more detail in the map on the other side, but you can see it there as well. Makeda, Azeka are in... If you look at the map, actually, it's an interesting map to look at for a moment. Do you see where it says, let's just work from, do you see where Gilgal is? Gilgal and Yericho? So the small dots are the Israelite army. The solid black lines are the original four kings who come out to help Yerushalayim in their campaign against Gibeon. The dotted line is the response of Israel. They go from Gilgal to Gibeon, and from Gibeon they chase the enemy first northwest to Beit Horon, and then south to Ayalon, Makeda, Azeka, Yamut. We're going to see all these names in these cities in the story in a moment. So they basically, the campaign starts with these kings come up here to Gibeon, and Yehoshua chases them out west. And then Yeshua will bring his army southward in a cleanup operation. Let's go back to the text. Vayhi benusam mibnei bnei Yisrael, as the Canaanites, the Amorites, are running from Israel, heim bimorad beit choron, they are on the retreat, on the hill, running away down the slopes of Beit Choron. Hashem ishlich alehem avanim gdolot min hashemayim ad azeka. And God threw upon them great stones. What are great stones? So it either means great, you know, large bricks of stone, or what's more likely is hail, some kind of hail, which, not sure of the season of this battle, but assuming that all of the events are happening in quick succession to each other, which is not unreasonable, remember they come into the land of Israel in the month of Nisan. They go straight up to Shechem, they come back. The battle of Yericho and the battle of Ai happen within a matter of days of each other. Givon was 3 days later. Everything's happening very quickly, although in Chazal, there's this notion of 7 years for the conquest of Canaan, but I'm not sure that's necessarily referring to the initial stages. It could be that the hail here is even more surprising because it may have been in the summer, and it doesn't usually hail in Israel in the summer months. Maybe. We're not sure. It never tells us the exact timing here.
Why wouldn't they use the word for hail if it was hail?
Because Avanim Gdolot Min HaShemayim sounds more dramatic.
And you have after Avnei Habalad.
Yeah.
Habalad is there.
You'll have it in a second. Vayamutu Rabim HaShemetu B'Avnei Habalad Me'asher Hargu B'nei Yisrael B'Charev. More died in the hail than died in and then died by the sword. Could have been hail combined with flash floods. It could have been many things, but it was certainly described as Avnei Barad or Avanim Gdolot, great hailstones. Az yedaber Yoshua laHashem b'yom tet Hashem et Amori lifnei bnei Yisrael. Yoshua then spoke these words to God on the day that God had gave him over the Amorites into his hands. Vayomer le'enei Yisrael, is declared before all of Israel, Shemesh b'givon dom, yareach b'emek ayalon. That the sun in Givon shall be silent, and the moon in the valley of Ayalon. Vayidom haShemesh v'yareach amad ad yikom goy oivav. The sun stood still, the moon stood until the nation destroyed its enemies. Alohi k'tuva al sefer hayashar. V'yamod haShemesh b'chatzi haShemayim v'lo'atz lavo ki yom tamim. The sun stood in the middle of the sky and did not set as it did in other days. V'lo haya k'yom ahu lefanav v'acharav lishmo haShem b'kol ish ki haShem nilcham b'Yisrael. This was unparalleled, this was unprecedented, that God should listen to the voice of man and do this great miracle because God was fighting for Israel. That's a paragraph into and of itself, and Bezrat Hashem in a probably not next week, but the first year after Pesach, we will look at this little episode and the miracle of the sun standing still by and of itself, and dedicate a shiur to the discussion of this little episode. But from a strategic point of view, what is the advantage of Shemesh B'Givon Dom? Forget the miracle for a moment. What is the strategic advantage of Yeshua's declaration that the sun should stand still, the sun should not set?
So they have time.
Time to do what?
To conquer everybody.
Right. The enemy is on the retreat. Remember, the battle starts in the morning. All night long they come, they take the enemy by surprise. The surprise disarms the enemy. Now they're on the retreat, they're running this way. If the sun sets on them, they have to stop the campaign. You can't fight at night. They don't have night glasses in the days of Yeshua. They can't fight at night. So to maximize the victory, it's necessary to maximize daylight hours. So on a very simple level, Yeshua says, Shemesh b'givon dam, I can't let the sun set, I need time. There's another advantage. Which way is the enemy running?
Sun.
Actually, no.
Well, they would be,
right? Because they would be, if the sun were to set, then Yeshua would be running into the sun, because they'd be running west. The sun is overhead. Shemesh b'givon dom. V'hayareach be'emak ayalon. They're running from Givon to Ayalon. Where's the sun? In Givon. Where's the areach? Emak ayalon. In other words, they are running westward. The sun is still overhead or behind them, and the moon is in front of them. But if the by the end of the day, the sun will be in the west, and they will be running into the sun. At present, the sun is behind them, which means that if the enemy turns to fight them, the enemy is looking into the sun. So that position where the sun is behind them and the moon is in front of them and they are running westward and the enemy is running away gives them the advantage that the enemy can't turn or would be challenged if they turn to counter offense and to turn back and attack because the sun is on their backs, meaning in the enemy's eyes. So that exact position of the sun in Givon is the most advantageous to him. And so you understand the message of Shemesh beGivon Dom vaHayareach beEmek Ayalon. Let the process just hold itself for a little bit. Give us this extra few minutes to finish the campaign. The depth of this miracle and its cosmological implications we will come back to in a couple of weeks. Pasuk Tedvav. VaYashav Yehoshua v'chol Yisrael imo ela machane haGilgala. The campaign ends when Yeshua and all of his army returns to Gilgal. When the war is over, these five kings went, and they were so decimated that they had no choice but to go and hide in a cave in Makedah. But of course, they were looking for them. They were told that these five kings were found. They found them. They found the cave where Saddam Hussein and his cohorts were hiding. Vayomer Yehoshua, golu avanim gdolim el pi ha-me'ara, vifkidu aleha anashim l'shomram. So he told his people who found the cave, he says, okay, go and cover the entrance to the cave with a giant rock. Meaning? Trap them inside. Trap them inside, and then let's see what happens. Then he tells his servants, the rest of the people of Israel, the army, don't stop. Go and finish the chase of your enemies. Destroy them. Don't let the army go back to the cities. This is the real conquest of Canaan. Up until now, they've had two major battles in two cities. This is the entire Shetach of the south open before them, because the four major armies that had united against them have now been decimated. Don't let the remnants of the army go back to defend the cities. The cities are defenseless. Now is your chance to take the cities one by one. Vayhi ki chalot Yeshua v'nei Yisrael hakotam makah gdola ma'od ad tumam v'hasvidim sardu mehem v'yavoi al arei ha-miftzah. The remnants started to run away and return to their fortified cities. Yeshivu kol ha'am le'machane Yehoshua makeda b'shalom l'chavat l'bnei Yisrael l'ish et l'shono. The people of Israel, the army camp of Yehoshua returned to Makeda l'chavat l'bnei Yisrael l'ish et l'shono. They marched all the way from Gilgal back to Makeda in the west, but at this point their march was uninterrupted. Nobody stood up against them. Lo charatz ish et lishono. Nobody spoke out against them or attacked them. It's a phrase which appears one other place in Chumash. Very timely phrase. Lo charatz ish et lishono. Very timely phrase for 2 weeks before Pesach. It says, no dog even barked. They were so frightened by the experience of Makat Bechorot.
I have a question about the translation. Did they annihilate everyone, or is that remnant still in the fortified city?
Well, they're going to go from city to city now and deal with it.
Okay, so at this point there is a remnant.
Probably. They're going to go from city to city. I don't know how many are left of the soldiers, but they're going to go from city to city.
The English translation
is
always...
Well, it's not so much that the translation is, it's just that there's a lot of generalities here. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of generalities and then specifics, so you sort of get these, you know, they annihilated them, and then they went from city to city to city. You have to take it as...
Okay.
V'yomer Yehoshua pitchu et Pi ha-me'ara, potziu elai et chameshet ha-malachim ha-ele min ha-me'ara. So Yeshua marches up to Makkedah and he says, okay, bring me out Saddam Hussein and his cohorts. Ve'yasu chayim ve'yatsu elav et chameshet ha-malachim ha-ele min ha-me'ara. They bring out these five kings, et melech Yerushalayim, et melech Hebron, et melech Yarmut, et melech Lachish, et melech Eglon. They bring out the five kings. Not sure why they keep mentioning Eglon by name. Eglon is a city. Devir Melech Eglon, I think there was some confusion as to whether the name of the city was Devir or the name of the city was Eglon. But alright. Vahi kohotziam et hamalachim ha'ele. O Yoshua, vayikra Yoshua et kol ish Yisrael v'yomer. They brought out these five kings. Then Yeshua said to the people as follows. Vayomer el ktinei anshei melchama. Hehalchu ito. Specifically to the generals who went with him. Kirvu simur et aglechem al tzavarei hamalachim ha'ele. Put your feet on the necks of these kings. Which is a classic ancient demonstration of conquest. You lay your enemy's king on the floor and you put your foot on their neck to demonstrate that you have conquered them. The demonstration here is very public and very intentional, because it's essentially a message that he needs to send to all of the nations, all the kings in the south. Don't be afraid, don't dismay, be strong, courageous. This was before the army of Israel. This is what God will do to all of your enemies. Yeshua then killed them, he executed them, and then he hung them, actually, on five trees. Why were they hung and not hanged?
Because they were dead.
Correct. Yeah. Which is exactly
just
this.
A demonstration.
Correct. Because they were dead already. Vayutluyim ala etzim ad ha'arev. And they remained hung there until the evening, because the Torah prohibits the hanging of the body of the executed dead beyond one day. That's the source of the prohibition of They get put into the cave, they get buried in this cave. They close the cave up, and there they remain buried.
What's their significance of why they were put back in the cave and closed up? Why didn't they just get buried
Because if you bury them normally, you create a monument for them.
But the cave still is being known as that's where they...
Maybe not. Now, city...
Respectful, if you think about it.
You're putting them in a cave.
You saw them like...
carcasses.
Yeah.
They're buried, but they don't get buried.
Respectful.
There's no monument to their deaths. City by city. Ve'et makeda lachad Yoshua b'yom ahu v'yakeh lifi charev ve'et malkah hechrim otam. ואת כל הנפש ששבה לא השאיר שריד ויעש למלך מקדה כאשר עשה למלך יריחו. City by city. The first city to go is Makedah. Destroy the city by the sword. Destroy the king. Not to leave any alive. Remember, we talked about the notion of whether not to leave any alive is a literal phrase or a code phrase for a certain type of battle. We talked about that at the beginning of last year. ויבוא יהושע וכל ישראל עמו ממקדה לבנה וילחם עם לבונה. The next city to go is Livona, or Livna, and similarly its king and its people, no one left. Of course, no one left again means a military phrase, not a literal one.
It's very very systematic how this was done.
Systematic, and you see the same psukim for each city. They're going city by city to conquer, essentially to clean up.
Next city is Lachish. ויתן השם את לחיש ביד ישראל וילכדה ביום השני ויעקיה לפי חרב ואת כל הנפש שבה בכל ככל אשר עשה ללבנה מקדה לבנה לחיש.
And if you actually look at the map, Lachish is down here. They've gone south, they've gone west, and now they're beginning to come south. Now they're beginning to come south from there. You can see on the map exactly the sequence: Makeda, Eglon, Dvir. We're going to get a couple of additional cities mentioned in a moment. Pasuk Lamed Gimel: Az ala Horam Melech Gezer, Lazoret Lachish. In the meantime, Lachish is in trouble. So the king of Gezer sends his army to assist in the conquest of Haram, or in the defense of Haram. So Yeshua has another city on Nich to add to his cities of conquest. Next city is Eglon. וילכדו ביומהו ביקור לפי חרב ואת כל הנפש ששבה ביומהו אחרים ככל אשר עשה ללחיש לחיש, אגלון. One after the other the cities begin to fall. ויעלו יהושע וכל ישראל עמו מאגלון חברונה וילחמו עליה וילכדו ויקור לפי חרב ואת מלכה ואת כל הרב ואת כל הנפש ששבה לו השאיר שריד ככל אשר עשה לאגלון ויחרם אותה ואת כל הנפש ששבה. Next on the city list is חברון. And Hebron falls in exactly the same way. I'm going through these psukim without even translating, because they're the same psukim for each one.
So he's almost like going in a circle.
He's going...
Because he was starting...
He went from
Gibbon,
and then
he went
out
to
push the enemy off the mountains into the plains, and then he's coming around south and cleaning up.
But Hebron is coming like... It's like a half a circle.
But if you will look in the Tetrabolith, I'm not sure, but I think it's very logical. You go via Kvish 443 now, like, you know, Modi'in, Yerushalayim. It's like, it's a nice way if you think about it. And then you go south. You look on it and it's logical than going via the mountain up and down.
He's going around the mountain,
right,
essentially.
Right. Yes.
He's going through the plains, through Emekai alone and then south.
And the Plishtim were already gone.
The Plishtim aren't a factor here yet. They're not here yet.
The next city is Devir. Vayilkada ve'et malkah ve'et kol harav ve'yakum lefichere ve'yachrim et kol hanefesh she'sheba lo ishiya sarid. Same phrase, same idea. Next city to go is Devir. Kashir asal lechevon. Ken asal ledvira ulamalka, v'chasher asal lelivna ulamalka. And then we have the summation pasuk. Vayakeh Yehoshua et kol haaretz. Yeshua has now taken basically, certainly the land of the south. Hahar, hanegev, v'hashvela, v'ha'ashedot. Ashedot is the side of Har Yehuda, the whole area of the south, the mountain, the Har, the Negev, down to Beersheba, the Shvela coast, the plain, the entire region is now in military control of Yehoshua. All the way down to Aza in the west, and Kadesh Barnea in the south. Kadesh Barnea, if you remember, was the jumping point for the story of the Meraglim when they came up from the south. In other words, Kadesh Barnea is the furthest southern point of the boundaries of Canaan as they were in those days. Essentially, somewhere on this map, but here, Kadesh Barnea.
you see Kadesh Barnea on the very bottom of the map?
Yeah.
So all the way down to Kadesh Barnea. Yeshua, this campaign starts with Yerushalayim, but it goes from Yerushalayim all the way down to the south to Kadesh Barnea into the Negev, and Yeshua has essentially taken the entire southern half from Yerushalayim. It's a very vast area, and it's a long campaign. And at the end of it, Vet Kol HaMelachim HaEle Ve'et Artzam L'Chad Yeshua Pamachat. All of the kings in one fell swoop. Ki Hashem Elokei Yisrael Nilcham LiYisrael. Why? For a simple reason. Eile V'recha Ve'ele V'asusim Anachnu B'Shem Hashem Elokeinu Nazkir. V'yashov Yehoshua V'chol Yisrael Imo El HaMachaneh HaGilgala. And that's probably the most important pasuk in this entire story. The end of the campaign, where do they go back to? Gilgal. They sweep through the entire south of the country. They sweep through all the way south of the Negev down to Kadesh Barnea. And when it's all done, city after city has fallen into their control. The entire army, the entire camp of Israel, goes back to Gilgal. Because that's where they're living, and that's where they will stay for many, many years.
I think it's more miracle that they could go back to Gilgal and not leave army in the place that, like, you know, that they wouldn't. That they didn't wasn't
because they're not yet. They're not yet ready. They're also working with a different set of assumptions, but they're not yet mentally ready to settle the land. The big difference is that for Yeshua it's a military campaign, but when the campaign is over, the expectation is that each tribe would go and settle in their territory. That's not happening, and that's the message here, that's not happening.
I'm not thinking about I'm speaking about when army go when Israel went into Lebanon. You cannot go out and assuming that the land will be the same way after you killed all the army there. But that's what basically happened. And they still was secure enough that nobody will come and take over. That's a big miracle that, like...
Well, it's either a big miracle or a big mistake.
Why, in the end, somebody went into
it? In the end, they have to reconquer everything. Tribe by tribe, because the key, and this is the one criticism leveled at Yeshua and at the generation of Yeshua, is that the purpose of the conquest was to lead to the settlement, and the settlement was supposed to be led by each tribe, and instead they keep running back to Gilgal, and we will get to that issue in more detail. All the tribes. That's
one
of the issues.
Why did they keep the people there?
So now you understand where we're going to have to what we're going to have to deal with in the second half of Yeshua. But the second half of Yeshua is exactly that issue. And he pushes them, and they don't go. And he pushes them, and they don't go. And God comes to him, and he says, "They're failing here." Sefer Shoftim begins with a list of all the places of the land of Canaan that are unconquered and unsettled because they didn't. They conquered it. They never went back, and they're going to have to reconquer it. They're going to have to back to all these cities.
Failing,
they have to go to Yeshua. They have to conquer Yerushalayim three times.
But isn't that Yehoshua's failing because he was the leader?
Yehoshua, the people. It's not clear in which generation the expectation was, but there's certainly something uncomfortable at this stage. It's just at the level of being uncomfortable of the fact that after the entire conquest, all of Shevet Yehuda and Shimon is now sitting in their grasp. And the entire camp of Israel, v'chol Yashav Yeshua, v'chol Yisrael imo, el machaneh haGilgal. You could argue the campaign's not over. He needs all the army. He's going to head north. You can argue many things, but at the end, when Perek Gimel begins with a declaration to Yeshua, Atazakanta, ve'aretz nishara habeh ma'od levishta, Yeshua, you've gotten old. And in the meantime, the land is still, for the most part, unsettled. And the second half of Yeshua deals with the challenges of the fact that they've conquered the land, but they haven't settled it. You have to wonder why they keep running back to Gilgal.
Where were all the other heads of the tribes? Nobody said anything?
Well, they're all doing the same thing. They're all going back to Gilgal. That's I don't necessarily know that's Yeshua's fault. Yeshua is at the end of the day is a military leader, but in the generation, the end of the conquest, post the conquest, this is the major issue. This is the major challenge that Yeshua will have to address, and all the tribes will have to address this issue. So it's partially miracle and partially miraculous and partially problematic than anything else. Partially problematic. What does the story remind us of, interestingly enough? When was the last time we had a battle of the unification of five kings?
Abraham.
Abraham also fought a unified army of five kings. Do you remember? Remember the story of Abraham and the five kings? The battle of the five kings against the four kings. In Sefer Breshit. I'll show you something interesting. The Givonim, here's an interesting optical illusion. How many kings are the Givonim fighting against?
Five.
And they are?
Debir,
Shalayim, Debir, Lachish,
Eglon,
and...
Eglon and Debir
is the same thing. Yishlaim, Debir, Lachish,
Hebron,
and Yarmut. Correct? Yarmut. Five kings. Against?
Yeshua.
No. Well, before Yeshua enters into the fray. Against? Givon. Right? Yes and no. Besides the Pact of Israel, Givon is not one city. Go back to the end of Perek Tet. When Israel finds them, Pasuk Yud Zayin. Vayisu b'nei Yisrael v'yavo el arehem. Israel finds the Givonim in their cities. V'yom ha-shlishi. V'arehem Givon v'yakfira u'v'erot v'kiryat Yarim. The names of the cities of the Givonim are Givon, Givon, Kfira, Be'erot, Kfira, Be'erot, and Kiryat Yarim. So what you really have in this story, interestingly enough, is a campaign of the five kings of Yerushalayim in the south against the four kings of Givon. The parallel between the story of Abraham and the war of the five kings against the four kings and the story of Yeshua and the five kings against the four kings begins to take on greater shape. Remember, the roles here change. In the story of Abraham, the story ends with the emergence of Melchizedek Melech Shalem, who was a bystander in that particular battle. In this particular battle, Yerushalayim is led by a king by the name of Adoni Tzedek, who's the ringleader in this story. But the parallels are there. I go one step further. The four kings in the time of Abraham are the four kings of... Who are the four kings in the time of Abraham?
Sdom,
Amorah,
Admah,
and Tzvayim. Melech Bela hi
Tzor.
So actually five kings. And who are the
Elam,
who are the four kings that fight against him?
Elam, Goyim, Shinar, Elasar.
The difference there was these are the empires. And these are the five, what are they called? Arei HaKikar, cities of the plains, little tiny cities in the little region of Yam HaMelech. So, little four five little shtetlach against four enormous armies of Kedar LaOmer who come marching through the land and conquering the entire region. Here, you have the five large armies of Yerushalayim, Tvir, Lachish, Chevron, Yamut, all against the four little shtetlach of Givon, Kfira, Beirut, Kiryat Yearim. And even though Yerushalayim is described, the king of Yerushalayim describes Kiryat Yearim as a major city, when you compare it in size and geography, right, you have an imbalance. But the fact that you have these five big kings against four little cities, or four big kings, big empires against five little cities, the parallels between these two stories are really remarkable. Let's add another dimension to the parallel. When Yehoshua hears about the threat to his allies, the Givonim, what does he do? He gathers his forces together and he attacks, right? Not quite. Doesn't go quite charging through the middle of the street saying, yeah! What does he do? They sneak up in the middle of the night. They spend an entire night moving his army and his forces again up through the until the point where in the morning they can make a surprise attack against the enemy. Correct? Now I'll show you something interesting. On this second page that I've prepared for you, I've given you the second page here with two. Right, you have the texts of the parak we just read. There are lots of copies. No, that's the wrong set. Wrong page. It's it just has two boxes of Hebrew text on it. There you go. That's why I had separated them, because they're two separate piles of sources. On the right-hand side, you have the story of Yehoshua. And I pointed out the names of the kings, even the way the phrases, even the way the kings are mentioned by name. Adon Tzedek Melech Yishalayim, Hoham Melech Hebron, Pi'am Melech Hermut, Yafir Melech Lachish, Dvir Melech Eglon. Sounds very similar to the way the names of the kings are described in Bereishit Perek Yud Daled. Amraphel Melech Shinar, Aryoch Melech Alasak, Dala Omer Melech Elam, Tidam Melech Goyim, Bera Melech Sdom, Vesham Melech Hamora, Shinav Melech Adma, Shemaev Melech Tzvayim. You have this description of the kings and their names and their cities, the four kings against the five kings. Sorry, the next one should also be in bold, Melech Belahitzar. And you have this war that takes place. Kedala Omer comes marching through the land. 14 years he conquers the land. And he takes on and he conquers the five cities of Sodom. In our story, after the campaign was over, where do the kings of the five cities go to? The cave. In the aftermath of the battle between the four kings and the five kings, when the five kings of Sodom lose the battle, what do? Take a look on Pasuk Yud. ועמק הסידים בירות בירות חמה וינוסו מלך סדום ואמרה ויפלו שמה והנשרים הרה נסו. They run into the tar pits and hide in the pits in the area. In other words, you also have this description of the kings who were vanquished running and hiding. There's a number of parallels between these two stories. It's really remarkable. What happens? Avraham hears about the story. Now, why is it engaging Avraham? Well, who cares? Why does Avraham even care about this battle?
Because they
captured Lot. And so he has a vested interest. His cousin, his relative, his Baal Brit, if you will, is threatened in this campaign. And so he decides to embark. Pasuk Yud Daled, Vayishma Avraham ki nishba achiv, Vayarak et chanichav yiledei beito, 18,300, gathers together as 318 people, Vayirdof adadan, Vayichalek aleihem laila, huva avadav. And he surprises them in the middle of the night by taking his entire group and secretly attacking in the middle of the night. And he chases them back, all the way back up to Damascus. In other words, the military strategy that Abraham employed was very similar to the military strategy that Yahushua employed, which was the element of surprise in the attack in the middle of the night, and then to push the enemy all the way back. Why is this parallel so significant for us? Because the result of both of these campaigns was essentially the same. What they accomplished was very similar. What did the campaign of Abraham in Kedarlah against the forces of Kedarlah Omer accomplish for Abraham? Remember, he had come to the aid of Lot. So he begins this campaign not as a campaign of conquest, but as a campaign of assistance, defense, liberation. The poor Lot and his people, the people of Sodom, were overridden by Kedarlah Omer. But it's not just Kedarlah Omer and Sodom. Kedarlah Omer's forces are the major empires of the north. The forces of Mesopotamia, Elasar, Aram, Elam, Shinar. Shinar is Babel. These are the empires of Mesopotamia. When they come marching through the land of Israel, and they come all the way down into the south, and then come back up to Emek HaMelech and engage a battle here, what they've basically done is they've conquered. This is a military conquest. Kedarlah Omer and his forces have conquered the entire land of Israel. When Abraham, in his counteroffensive, in order to defend Sodom, in order to liberate Lot, fights back and the forces of Kedarlah Omer all the way back to Damascus, what has he done for the land of Israel? He's liberated it. He's conquered it, for all intents and purposes. In a world in which the rule is conqueror takes all, Abraham has, at that moment, conquered the land of Canaan. He has acquired it legally, militarily. He has conquered the land of Canaan. When he walks, we talked about this once before, I believe. When he walks into Hebron and asks to negotiate for the land for his wife, and they say to him, "Nasi Elokim ata bekirbeinu," that you are Nasi Elokim. It's not just an expression of politeness. Abraham is the conqueror of the entire land. Why on earth would they charge Abraham a penny for the land that he just liberated from the conquering forces of Kedarlah Omer? If you understand that, the background here, the conquest of the four kings and the five kings, Abraham's role there was in a war of self-defense imposed from the outside. He had no, it wasn't a military conquest. But for all intents and purposes, at that moment, Abraham had militarily conquered the entire land of Canaan, liberated it, and had legal claim to it. The campaign of Yahushua in the south starts not as a military conquest of the land of Canaan, not as an effort to take Canaan away from the Canaanites. It starts as a war of defense against the armies, the conquering armies of Yerushalayim and its allies against Baal Brit, against Givon. Givon didn't start the war against Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim started the war against Givon. Called Israel to come and help, and they did. And in that moment, liberated and conquered the land of Israel. So suddenly, the whole conquest of Canaan takes on a different character. The only city that we actually attacked directly, initially and as an act of initial aggression, is the city of Jericho. And Jericho is the center of the idolatry of Baal. The rest of the campaign takes place because we made a breach with the Givonim. The rest of the Canaanites came to attack the Givonim. We came to the aid of our Baalei Brit, much as Abraham had come to the aid of Lot and the people of Sodom. So the parallel, I think, is fascinating because it sets the stage for the whole conquest of Canaan to take place on a very different footing to what we would have otherwise expected or anticipated or even have understood. That's it. Yirtzeh Hashem, next week.